Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. This is part two in our two-part series on the self-proclaimed Hobo King of not just the United States, but also Belize in Central America. He goes by two or three names. He was born Leon Ray Livingston in 1872. He is perhaps better known on the roads and rails of North America as A Number One. If you haven't heard part one of today's episode, please, please, please pause this. Listen to that part and then tune into this episode, because I promise you it will make way more sense. My name is Ben. I will not reveal my hobo name on air.
Yeah, I still go by Squeaky Chair. That's my hobo name. Noel is my Christian name, the name my mother gave me.
Isn't your middle name Christian?
Yes, it actually is. That's I didn't even think about that. Noel Christian Squeaky Chair Brown is what they call me on the rails. A Number One is what they called our boy Livingston on the rails. And it was after his return from that time spent in Central America that he decided to give himself this nickname that would really cement his legacy. A Number One. He wrote first about this in his book. He said the moniker was given to him by a traveling companion by the name of Frenchie. He said, "Every tramp gives his kid a nickname, a name that will distinguish him from all other members of the craft." I love that, referring to this life as the craft. "You have been a good lad while you have been with me. In fact, been always A Number One in everything you had to do. And kid, take my advice. If you have to be anything in life, even if a tramp, try to be A Number One all the time and in everything you undertake." He also recommended that Livingston leave his mark literally everywhere that he went by carving A Number One into mile markers as he passed them on his train travels, so people would know that he'd been there. And this really gets into our idea of hobo code and of a secret language of symbols that were used by those in this kind of freewheeling, traveling life to help communicate with one another non-verbally. And here's the thing, Ben, to your point in the previous episode, today you can still find A Number One scribbles under bridges, in addition to this kind of series of hieroglyphs that Livingston supposedly, at the very least, helped to proliferate and preserve and possibly even created. Something that I know you've been fascinated with for a long time, Ben, hobo code.
Yeah, I want to first off shout out someone who has written their mark in all of our hearts, I would say. One of my favorite off-the-grid travelers, LeBouche, who is a close associate of our super producer, Casey Pegram. You're right, Noel. Hobo code is a fascinating thing. To the point about A1, I know a lot of us listening today are wondering about the etymology of the phrase. We know that it traces at least back to 1837. It was probably used in Lloyd's of London, the insurance company's maritime system for rating of merchant vessels, of commercial watercraft, which actually jibes with Livingston's story of, you know, hitting the ocean as well as the rails. So perhaps Frenchie himself had some sort of sailor stories in his background.
Also, not a bad steak sauce.
Hobo code is a tricky thing, right? You know, one of the big revelations that you can learn about hoboing in general, the tramp lifestyle, the vagabond lifestyle, is that it still exists here in the United States and in other parts of the world. But how often was hobo code used? How ubiquitous was it, or how rare was it? We know that you can find books dating back to the early 20th century that show at least some of these pictograms. They're the things that we each described in episode one, like a circle with an arrow saying go this way, or Noel, you mentioned the A-frame tattoo that you're considering.
Yeah, it just means safe harbor, which is kind of broad. I like that as a concept, just the idea of, like, you know, finding refuge somewhere. I think that's sort of the idea. There would be ones that would indicate the water is bad. There would be, like, you know, people would draw it maybe with a piece of chalk on a well, implying that the water was contaminated in some way. There would be very specific ones, like, there's a kindly old lady in this town that will give you free food, you know, things like that. It really was interesting how specific some of them would get. When you look at them pulled back, like you can Google these, they really do resemble hieroglyphics in a lot of ways, just the shape of them. Ooh, and by the way, you can get a hobo code coffee mug from Society 6 right now, which is pretty cool. There's one that says, kind lady lives here. That is actually a cute little kitty cat. Two lines next to each other, parallel lines, says the sky is the limit. Not quite sure what that means. There's one that looks like a fermata, which is a musical symbol that you put over a note implying that you hold it indefinitely. So it's like an arc and a little dot in the middle. And I do believe that one means that the authorities in this town are hostile. And that would be a lot of these because, you know, hobos weren't taken too kindly in some cities, in some towns. They would be run out of town on a rail, where that came from. And, you know, so these symbols would be to kind of warn fellow travelers that maybe your presence here would not be welcome, that you'd be met with hostility and even violence.
Yeah. And it makes sense that these sort of symbols would proliferate. They have three very clever things about them. First, they function in a camouflaged way. If you are not familiar with where to look, if you are not familiar with what these symbols mean, they could easily be taken as errant graffiti. Second, they're very easy to make. There's nothing, you know, you don't have to be a master artist to carve out, straight lines, triangles, and circles, but it still conveys the message. And third, it functions as an invisible language. It's a form of communication, right? That is strictly for those in the know. It's not clear yet whether Livingston played a huge role in creating a lot of hobo code, but he is credited with mainstreaming this, I would say, because for a lot of people in the U.S., especially people who are well off enough to buy books and to have the leisure time to read books, this is the moment they learn about this secret language. They learn about it from the self-appointed hobo king, Livingston. And he is, like, right now, to put it in perspective, if Livingston were alive in 2020, he would be doing TED Talks. He would be the guy with a clicker in a really nice suit talking about my 30 years as a hobo and what that teaches us about America.
Yeah, and entrepreneurial stick-to-itiveness.
Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is he became more of a cultural figure that, like, more of a media representation of a hobo than an actual hobo.
That's absolutely true, Ben. And we mentioned at the top of the show, he had like a $40 suit and he carried around a weird collection of autographed pictures. Isn't that right, Ben? That he would use to impress people, or I guess just, how did he even have access to these? Who was it?
Oh, Thomas Edison, William Howard Taft, Theodore Roosevelt, who is, as everybody knows, most famous for his several appearances here on Ridiculous History. And yeah, he's creating his own story, you know, and it's a snowball effect, right? It's an aggregate process. He begins to influence the world around him, and he is increasingly attempting to, at this point in his life, lead people away from a life on the road or a life on the rails. In fact, how exciting is this? If you are a reader in the early 20th century, you open a book and you see a disclaimer first off. And this disclaimer says, wandering, once it becomes a habit, is almost incurable. So never run away, but stay at home, as a roving lad usually ends in becoming a confirmed tramp. You know what I mean? I don't know how you guys felt when you were kids watching home movies and you would see the FBI warning coming up. I always thought that made something legit. You know what I mean? So that's how people felt when they read these books. They saw this disclaimer. It's a page turner. He said that it was a pitiful existence that would end up leading people to a pauper's grave. It's illustrative of, I don't know, like ostensibly it's a warning, but I think it's more so the Barnum aspect I was talking about in episode one. He's trying to entice and tantalize people.
Yeah, it reminds me of like that episode we did about wanderlust and how it was like almost looked at it as a disease, that kind of warning. It's like, stay put or else you're going to become some kind of pariah, some sort of the social, you know, like leper, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good observation, too. We have to remember that this is happening during a massive expansionist phase, right, in the U.S. or in North America. And so people are, even if people aren't traveling widely, they're fascinated by the idea of doing so. I mean, it's a dream, isn't it, to travel without hindrance? And it's a dream that Livingston capitalizes on. He is making himself a celebrity. To your earlier point, Noel, not only was he carrying around autographs from notable historical figures or the titans of the day, he also, this is how self-aware he is, he's also seeking out local news reporters in every city of note that he happens across. So he's in St. Louis, you know, maybe he goes back to Truckee, California. Who knows? He's in Poughkeepsie. He's in Atlanta, wherever. We can make cities up at this point. One of the first things he does is go to the local newspaper office and say, "Have you heard of me? I'm A1, the Hobo King, and I'll do an interview with you." And it works. People love these stories. They get published everywhere. And so he becomes so well known that authors and artists start picking up this idea. You know, he represents this concept. Jack London, author of White Fang and The Call of the Wild, and I think one of my favorite stories from Jack London is a short story called To Build a Fire. This guy, Jack London, he's growing up and he loves A1. He writes to Livingston and says, you know, tell me about the hobo lifestyle in the late 1800s. And they actually go on a trip together, I think. An epic road trip, which, by the way, Livingston also capitalizes on in a later book called From Coast to Coast with Jack London.
Amazing, amazing title.
It's, get this, Noel, it comes out in 1917, 1 year after Jack London actually passes away.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's an oof.
Ben, you are spot on about Livingston being like a proto TED Talk type. I mean, seriously, he really is kind of cultivating this cult of personality, I guess, for lack of a better expression, not to be redundant with reusing the cult sound twice. But it's true. He's building like a lifestyle around this kind of hobo world, and absolutely capitalizing on this this sort of hobo lifestyle. And you know, considering, you know, we've talked about the romanticized version of it that he certainly was the pioneer of, but this was not as much of a choice at this point as we maybe originally set it up to be. It really was people that were in desperate need of income and would do whatever it took and go whatever, wherever they needed to go in order to get it. And we're on the heels of the Great Depression too, when this lifestyle absolutely became critical for people to even survive, and migrant farm workers. And we know how that went. If you've read Steinbeck's wonderful chronicle of this time period, The Grapes of Wrath. So a little problematic that he's sort of capitalizing on this. He's almost sort of like a Phobo. I just coined that. Sorry. It's okay. I like it though. Phobo. You know, he really is sort of doing this for his own big picture kind of publishing rights, kind of residual return, kind of end game, right?
Yeah. So he predates the Great Depression, or he anticipates it. And this is still the romanticized version of the vagabond in U.S. culture, because the Great Depression has not hit. When it does, in when we get to the stuff Steinbeck's writing about, you know, we're talking about thousands and thousands of people who didn't want to travel for fun. They wanted to stay at home. They wanted to keep their house. This is not a spiritual journey for them. Nowadays, and I do like Phobo, Noel, I think that's well written, but nowadays the term would be something like Oogle. With two O's, O-O-G-L-E. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but you can learn more about it. That's the thing. Livingston did not have to do this. He liked doing this. He was primarily an author, a depictor, a describer of this life. In fact, he had, actually, like many itinerant travelers of the time, he had a couple of, let's call them home bases, let's call them stop-ins. You know how, I don't know, Casey, Noel, have you guys ever had an outside cat as a friend? And like, you know, the cat's got somewhere that it sleeps, but it stops by houses.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there is a gas station around the corner from my old house where the employees there would actually put out food, and so that place was just like a hub of itinerant cat friends.
What about you, Casey?
Yeah, my dad at his office had that sort of cat, called him Tiger. He hung around for years and years, just, you know, coming to the back door and getting a little bit of food, a little bit of milk, that kind of thing, and kind of going on his way. And very friendly, but at the same time, assertive and independent, you know?
Yeah, they're making a circuit, right? That's kind of what Livingston appears to be doing. One of his home bases is a place called Mrs. Cunningham's Boarding House in Cambridge Springs, Pennsylvania. Mrs. Cunningham's Boarding House, by the way, sounds like something that Noel and Casey and I would make up as a wholesome spot in our screenplay, right? Oh, let's go to Mrs. Cunningham's Boarding House. You know, they have a Sunday roast every Sunday. Look, we're still working out the script, but that's where he wrote a lot of books.
It is indeed, including The Ways of the Hobo, where he actually claimed that the house became a mecca to other hobos of his ilk, which he referred to as chronic hobos. Seems a little insulting, but whatever. And he referred to his friends Hobo Mike and Denver Johnny. I love Hobo Mike. Just get right to it. And they would come by, you know, just to kind of rap and get some advice and, you know, and just kind of have someone to spend some time with, a little companionship when they passed through.
Speaking of companionship, ridiculous historians, we've got a twist for you. This story turns out to be a little bit of a rom-com. Because you see, Livingston did not spend his entire life on the road. He did not die on the rails. In 1914, he officially tied the knot with a woman named Mary Trotsky, and he tried to settle down in Erie, Pennsylvania. Noel, what was the word that people were using as the female equivalent of hobo? What'd you call it?
It was Boet.
Boet.
B-O-E-T-T-E. Yeah. I don't know about that one, but it's interesting. Remember in the Wolf Whistle episode how we were totally taken for a ride for the idea of the female equivalent of a wolf whistle called the slurp. Utter fallacy. Loved it, though, that we took us all a minute to kind of be like, wait a minute. Sometimes it's, again, there's a lot of similarities in this story where sometimes, you know, you can't let the facts stand in the way of a good story, as my mother would say. But yeah, he settled down. The hobo king, a number one himself, settled down in Erie, Pennsylvania. And he spent time, you know, working various jobs from electric companies to steel, all around the area. And eventually, according to one source that we found, he got into real estate. It's pretty lucrative compared to all of these, you know, itinerant jobs that he'd been doing over the years. And I don't know, we don't have a sense that he like made a mint or anything off of his publishing. Ben, what did you discover in that department? Because he definitely was sort of a minor celebrity at this point. You know, he really was kind of the most famous hobo in America. Can't imagine they didn't get some good coin from all that stuff.
Yeah. He was no Mansa Musa or Jeff Bezos. Those are probably, well, Mansa Musa is the richest person in the history of civilization that we know of, and Jeff Bezos is well on the way. But yeah, he wasn't, you know, he didn't buy an entire railroad, for instance. That's something that you would do if you liked railroads and you were a billionaire, a multimillionaire. He probably was traveling the lecture circuit for income. He probably needed to do that. And it was very common for people of note to become orators later in life. And interestingly enough, the majority of his lectures about this this movable life, let's call it. Actually, I'm going to write that down. That's a great title for a story.
I love that.
This movable life that he is into, he speaks against it in these lectures. You know, mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys, except switch out cowboys for hobos. And at this point, we have arrived at the time in history when the Great Depression does hit. Livingston is alive. He is fighting against tramping. Unfortunately, right now, we know that he made these anti-hobo, anti-vagabond lectures, but we don't have a copy of them. So we don't know what he actually said. And once again, we find ourselves left with rumors, right?
Yeah, and they range from the fantastic to the banal. My favorite, which would just be like the poetic way for him to end his life, is that he died in a train wreck in Houston, Texas in 1944. But he apparently had impersonators because he had such a, you know, high profile that he literally had hobo copycats that were sort of biting his shtick. And it's possible that this was confused with a 1912 train wreck that killed one of these pretenders to the crown, the hobo crown. Mainly the most reliable version of his passing has him succumbing to heart failure in his home on April 5th of 1944 at the ripe old age of 71 with his wife standing by. So yeah, it's interesting, but makes a lot of sense, I guess, that, you know, somebody who was so invested in mythologizing his life and becoming this larger than life kind of figure, that there's still some mystery that surrounds the way he left this mortal coil. And, you know, he's not someone that I'd ever heard of before, you know, Gabe hipped us to this topic. But he was dramatized in a film. His relationship with Jack London is probably the most enduring pop culture kind of remnant of his story. And Lee Marvin actually played him in a film in 1973 called The Emperor of the North, which was based on Livingston's time on the road with Jack London and London's book, The Road.
And then, of course, we see the thematic descendant there in Jack Kerouac's On the Road. I'm not going to disparage one or the other. I'm just going to say Jack London wrote a book called The Road. Jack Kerouac later wrote a book called On the Road. Sort of like Ghostbusters and the real Ghostbusters, if you guys remember that animated series. I have a book here that would be interesting for people who want another opinion. You see, while Livingston is the self-appointed hobo king, many people in that community did not consider him necessarily the be-all, end-all. He was just the most mainstreamed version of people who were largely ignored by American society. There's a book I found called The Last Great American Hobo. Casey Noel, you guys can see this face here on the Zoom. This was published in 1993, and it traces what the author calls the life of the oldest active hobo left. This is strange because we see again that history doesn't ever stop. You know what I mean? It doesn't exist in the past tense. There's so much more stuff we could talk about with hobos, though. You know, hobo code, importantly, does actually exist to some degree. And for any of our fellow ridiculous historians who are saying, hey, maybe this hobo king didn't actually travel very much at all, we do have to point out that Susan Phillips, an anthropologist at Pitzer College, did not just find hobo code. She saw actual marks from A number one, which means Leon Ray Livingston did at least hit the rails to some degree. So there is some truth to his story. He's not completely lying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. Again, it's the devil's in the details, right? But he wasn't the only one. She found references and kind of tags, I guess. You think of graffiti culture now, and it's all about, you know, having that name and having that style. Or like, you know, with Basquiat, he had the little crown. Or it's all about people knowing exactly who you are and leaving your mark. That is largely where this came from, is this kind of train culture and this hobo culture, and folks like Oakland Red and the Tucson Kid. And what did we say earlier? There was Hobo Steve. No, it wasn't Steve, but it was something.
Hobo Mike.
Hobo Mike. Good old Hobo Mike. I love that. And, you know, if I had been around in those days, I think Squeaky Chair would have made a dent. I think that would have been remembered fondly.
Do you think people would have just started calling you Squeaky?
Squeaky's, that's way better. That's a way better hobo name, Ben. That's a really good point.
Do you want, you know, from what I understood, the rule was in those days that it was like the same with any nickname. Someone else had to give you the name.
That's right.
There's another fact that I was dying to mention throughout part one of this episode. We'll mention it now, but I'm not going to give the full story because we are a family show. You guys remember the song Big Rock Candy Mountain? Noel, this is familiar to you from stuff they don't want you to know.
Yeah, totally.
Big Rock Candy Mountain is a relatively innocuous song, the version that exists in the modern day. However, the original version has an extra verse, which is sinister and disturbing and gives light to the realities of living without a home.
because, you know, we've mainly been focusing on, in this one, especially, you know, with Livingston himself, him having made this choice, you know, very consciously, because he had family. His family didn't even disown him. We have that part a little ways back where they write to him and are pleased to hear of his exploits. And he probably could have gone home and, you know, lived off of their largesse anytime he wanted to. They seem to do just fine. But we haven't even talked about the idea of, like, kids that are, you know, living this life because they have no parents. Either their parents have died or maybe they were abused and they ran away. And yeah, the lyric in Big Rock Candy Mountain is all about kind of almost selling those kids into a type of slavery. And that is absolutely a thing. If you think about, like, in Pinocchio, for example, the idea of those kids that are sort of these, like, living under sort of a much less benevolent hobo king who would, you know, put these kids to work and have them running grifts for him, like in Oliver, for example. So there is absolutely a dark side to what we have largely characterized as kind of like a freewheeling, you know, sunny, go where you want kind of mentality. Can't forget that. But it's very interesting how this guy is essentially stood the test of time, largely, I think, because of his relationship with Jack London, as being sort of one of the most famous hobos in the history of the life, I guess. And he actually wrote 12 books on hobo life, and you can still see his mark, you know, etched into stone and underpasses, because these train lines have been around for a long time. It's very difficult to just uproot that kind of infrastructure. I think a great place to end this two-part series, which I have absolutely enjoyed, is with just a couple of excerpts, quite long, from a disclaimer that Livingston put at the beginning of all 12 of his books, where he kind of sets up with his backstory a little bit and sort of the choice he made, you know, to live this life. But then he also does acknowledge that dark side that we talked about just a second ago.
Yeah, there's interesting language here that indicates showmanship. And also indicates a little bit of what I would call styling on it in the parlance of our own day. First off, he reveals his age. Perhaps some may think that a man who has attained only the age of 38 years has hardly enough accrued experience to justify him in writing an autobiography. Good point, right? But then he uses pretty academic language when later he says, "Were other men of my age to write their life story, it could ordinarily be summed up with Caesarean brevity." Really? Caesarean brevity? Is that even in the early 1900s, are people saying that?
I don't know about that one, Ben. It's but he's definitely got a gift in terms of his colorful language and the way he paints a picture. He wraps it up with this description here that I think does a really good job of characterizing kind of the ups and the downs and all of the different pitfalls that can be associated with the hobo life. Quote, "There's a dark side to a tramp's life. For every mile stolen on trains, there is one escape from a horrible death. For each mile of beautiful scenery and food in plenty, there are many weary miles of hard walking with no food or even water, through mountain gorges and over parched deserts. For each warm summer night, there are 10 bitter cold long winter nights. For every kindness, there are a score of unfriendly acts. A tramp is constantly hounded by the minions of the law, is shunned by all humanity, and never knows the meaning of home and friends."
You can read the entire disclaimer, courtesy of Harvard University, online now. Just check out, you know, just find your search engine of choice and check out Born to Ramble, Harvard University. Hobo King, Livingston. We've got the keywords for you. I do have to say, this guy is a fantastic writer, and it speaks very highly of his craft that he is still so compelling and enjoyable today. In fact, Livingston plays a huge part in the modern 2020 sort of archetype of the hobo. I believe a lot of our fellow ridiculous historians are probably familiar with the Boxcar Children book series. I don't know about you. I never read it. I was more a scary stories to tell in the dark kind of guy when Scholastic rolled through.
Totally. Yeah, I never read those either, but they were definitely on the shelf in my, like, I want to say fifth grade class. Seems about right. I was more into the more dark and depressing kind of stuff and like the Bridges to Terabithia and, you know, The Giver and all that stuff. But they were definitely super popular and absolutely kind of dramatized, made a little more palatable for a young adult audience, this kind of hobo life. But I'm sure there were some trials and tribulations in there. Again, having not read the books, I can't really say for sure, but I know they were very popular and absolutely influenced by this gentleman's proliferation of this kind of culture.
I think the box, I think maybe their parents passed away and they had to live in a boxcar or I don't know. If anybody is a fan of Boxcar Children, please send us a summation arguing for or against us reading it. Casey, it looks like you're not our big Boxcar Kids champion here.
No, I mean, I remember them from the Scholastic Book Fair, but I never picked up a copy of that series.
The Scholastic Book Fair was so awesome. I wish we could have, like, we don't have those as adults. We just have bookstores and Amazon. You know, how cool would it be if one day we were all working in our office and management just said, "Hey, everybody, stop everything. The book fair's coming." I would lose my mind.
Yeah, it sounds pretty perfect.
Speaking of perfect, I gotta say, this is maybe my favorite two-parter we've ever done. This one really had a lot of interesting twists and turns to it. And I got to pat ourselves on the back here, gentlemen. I'm really happy that we split this up the way we did and gave Mr. Livingston his due.
Yes, and we hope you enjoyed this journey. We would love to hear from you. What are your favorite tales of off-the-grid adventures? Have you ever found yourself traveling in a similar fashion? If so, we want to hear your stories. You can find us on the internet. We're all over it. We are, in fact, a podcast. So we're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. You can also find us as individuals.
Yeah, if you want to, you can hit me up on Instagram. I am at HowNowNoelBrown.
And I am on Twitter as BenBolinHSW. I am on Instagram as Casey Pegram, number one fan. No, sorry, Casey, I wasn't that creative. I'm just at Ben Bolin on Instagram.
And you can also find us on Facebook, where we have a pretty cool group called Ridiculous Historians, where you can interact with your fellow listeners and get into meme games and lots of fun chat. Really good folks there. Lots of fun, nice, lighthearted conversation on Ridiculous Historians on Facebook. You just have to name one or both or all three of us, or just say something that lets us know that you're a human being that actually knows that the show is a thing. And you're in.
Yeah, send me an image of your favorite hobo code. Here's a question too. If you could create hobo code for the 20th century, wait, we're in the 21st century. Casey, keep this part in. We'll just do it again. If you could create hobo code for the 21st century, what would it be? I imagine it would be like Wi-Fi availability, maybe?
Yeah, or like, you know, public restrooms. That's a big thing, even if you're not a hobo. I mean, God, New York City, a free public restroom is like a unicorn. So
yeah, Manhattan has a huge problem with that. I think it's part of the reason they could have so many Starbucks. They're functioning as the public restrooms of downtown. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry, Starbucks. But thanks as always to Christopher Hasiotis, to Casey Pegram, to Alex Williams, who composed that slap and bop you hear at the beginning of every episode.
Slap and bop. Bop and slap. Love it. Love Alex Williams. And please check out his podcast, Ephemera, available on the iHeart Podcast Network as well. Huge thanks to Eves Jeffcoat, Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit, Jonathan Strickland, that devious quister. We hope to have him back very, very soon. And as always, man, thanks to you, Ben. This was a delightful romp.
Back at you, Noel. I guess we'll see each other on the road.
And we'll see you next time. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.